Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Stereo MC's The Writings on the Wall. How does remote control technology change war? Today, we'll begin a journey into this new landscape of war by robot, and we'll surface just a few of the issues associated with this fast-emerging technology. Before we do that, we'll talk with three activists arrested in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, the inauguration of President Obama, and the start of the 111th Congress. Their court case was just dismissed this last week on January 22nd. Meanwhile, Interpress Service is reporting from Jerusalem that Israel's hardline government may be backtracking on two major planks of its policy in the occupied territories, resisting demands for a blanket freeze on all settlement building in the West Bank and acquiescing to the end of its tight siege of the Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip. As a result, several pieces in an elaborate diplomatic puzzle that seeks to resolve both a long standoff in Israel-Palestinian relations and a three-year showdown in Palestinian-Palestinian relations since Hamas won the Palestinian elections, are beginning to fall into place. Even a full-fledged truce between Israel and Hamas, something that has proven elusive since the end of the 22-day Gaza War last January, suddenly seems not beyond the realm of possibility. President Obama's administration generated this initial momentum, but Egypt is fostering a dramatic change within Palestinian domestic policies that would allow Hamas and the Fatah-controlled Palestinian Authority to work towards ending their power struggle. Another round of talks between Fatah and Hamas representatives got underway in Cairo yesterday, with Egyptian mediators trying to convince the two sides to accept a reconciliation agreement that could yield a new Palestinian governing authority in Gaza. Egyptian National Intelligence Chief General Omar Suleiman and his deputy, Mohammed Ibrahim, have designated July 7th as a deadline, warning that if Fatah, represented by former Prime Minister Ahmed Kouria, and Hamas, headed by Politburo Deputy Chief Moussa Abu Marzouk, continue to remain at loggerheads, Cairo would withdraw its mediation. Key elements in the Egyptian proposal include Hamas agreeing to relinquishing some of its control over the Gaza Strip. This would pave the way towards a ceasefire agreement with Israel. Then the subsequent lifting of the siege of Gaza through the opening of the border crossings with both Israel and Egypt would allow the setting up of a committee under Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, charged with administering Gaza. Collaterally, military and security experts from Egypt and other Arab countries would be stationed in Gaza to oversee the revamped Joint Palestinian Authority forces, made up jointly of Fatah and Hamas units, which would, inter alia, be responsible for supervising the border crossings on the Palestinian side. Finally, new Palestinian elections are mooted for January next year. The end result, backed actively by the US and the EU, is to see the start of a process that will pave the way for renewed negotiations between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. Egypt, the US, and the EU all recognize that without an internal Palestinian deal, Palestinian-Israeli talks will be futile. Up until now, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has declared himself ready to resume talks, but bound as he is to the destruction of Hamas by coalition agreements with the ultra-nationalistic flank of his government, Netanyahu has ruled out any contacts with the Palestinians where Hamas to be included in any shape or form with the PA. The PA, on the other hand, balks at any resumption of talks with Israel so long as Israel does not abide by the U.S. demand on settlements. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak is weighing in with a tantalizing inducement to Israel, offering gradual normalization of relations between the pro-peace Arab states and Israel, even in advance of any sort of agreement towards peace with the Palestinians, but on the proviso that Israel makes a move on settlements first. During a trip to Europe last week, Netanyahu discovered that even France and Italy, heretofore Israel's quote-unquote best friends, insist on such a freeze. This was underlined when the foreign ministers of the US, EU, Russia, and the UN, meeting in Trieste in Italy, issued an identical demand. Faced with such concerted pressure, Netanyahu is dispatching his defense minister, Ehud Barak, to Washington Monday with a counteroffer. Reportedly, Netanyahu may even go so far as to agree to a total 3-month hiatus in settlement building to sway the administration from its unyielding position. Is Netanyahu, despite his strong ideological commitment to the settlement enterprise, beginning to recognize that he can ill afford to stand pat in the face of the U.S., joint Egyptian pincer strategy? Stay tuned. The writing's on the wall, but if your mind's neglected, stumble, you might fall, stumble, you might fall. On January 20th, 2009, 70 people came to Washington, D.C. with a message for the 111th Congress. End the war, end the killing. They were referring to wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and U.S.-sanctioned bombings of Gaza. 20 of the 70 who marched that day chose to take their grievances to those in power, to those who had authorized the acts of aggression, and to those new members who would have to decide whether to continue the carnage or call for its end. They marched in a solid procession, which ended in the atrium of the Hart Senate building, where they respectfully spoke the names of those who had perished prematurely and unnecessarily. Police disrupted this constitutionally protected speech on the grounds of illegal assembly and disorderly conduct. The court case was dismissed on June 22nd. With me on the phone from Washington, D.C. is Pete Perry, who was arrested that day and in court recently. Pete Perry is a peace and social justice activist who has been affiliated with the D.C. Anti-War Network and the National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance. Welcome, Pete Perry.
Hello, yes. Thank you for having me online.
Well, it's great to have you with us today, and I'm going to ask you to describe that day, what led up to it and what happened.
Yes, that day was actually the first day of the 111th Congress, and Lori Arbeiter, who acted with me that day, she's one of the co-founders of the Activist Response Team, which I love their acronym, ART, and they are a group of activist artists from New York, primarily, and they organize what was called the March of the Dead. And each person in this march dresses in black and wears a white mask evoking those folks that have been killed in unnecessary, illegal, and immoral wars. And each one of us also carried a name of a man, woman, child killed in Afghanistan, Iraq, and in Gaza. I carried the name of Mohammed Iman al-Hajul, a 4-month-old girl that was killed in Gaza. She was killed while being held by her mother by F-16s supplied by our nation to the Israeli Defense Forces. That was the first, like I said, the first day of Congress. So we're trying to communicate to Congress to cut off funding for these wars and violent occupations of other lands and instead divert money to greatly needed social needs here at home. You know, every year we spend hundreds of billions of dollars of our own tax money on these wars and occupations. So we wanted to act that day and exercise the right that we have in the First Amendment to petition a redress of grievances. I was one of the ones arrested inside the Hart Senate office building following the march. We marched around Capitol Hill, and then many of us went inside. There was a group that hung banners. One banner said Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine, and another banner said we will not be silent, and a third banner, a really large one, which I didn't see actually because I was standing on the other side of the atrium. There's a large Alexander Calder statue in the middle of it. I couldn't even see the third banner, but I saw the photographs later, and that one is really quite powerful. It says, "The Audacity of War Crimes." Mm-hmm. And we, a group of us, stood in the near the middle of the atrium and read the names of many, many civilians killed in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Gaza. And there were other groups of supporters that were clapping when the banners were unfurled. But they weren't arrested. It was us that were more solemn and respectfully reading the names and wearing these masks and being completely nonviolent and not blocking any entrance or exits. We were the ones that were arrested that day, 17 of us in total.
What do you make of that, that the other group was not, no one from the other group was arrested?
I think that it clearly says that if you have a strong political message and you're not a politician, that your expressing of that message is not really welcomed there in the halls of power. You know, so often us as citizens are not heard. It's the politicians, the talking heads and so forth that are heard. And that's why the other banner, "We will not be silent," is very important. Mm-hmm.
Were the police violent when they arrested you?
No. In Washington, and particularly the last few times these actions have happened on Capitol Hill, there's the Capitol Hill police. They're completely nonviolent. This happens quite a bit. They're accustomed to it. Some of them are not very friendly towards us, but other ones surprisingly are friendly to us and thank us for continuing to do what we're doing by speaking out against violent wars of aggression and so forth.
Interesting.
So there's a division, you know, person to person. And no, in D.C., I think most of the, there are like, I don't know, over 25 different police agencies in D.C., and the National Capitol Hill Police is just one of them. Mm-hmm. But they're all pretty well trained on how to handle protests.
Pete Perry, talk a little bit about the D.C. Anti-War Network.
Yeah, that was a group that is not really active as a group anymore. Many of the individual activists are still involved in anti-war, anti-torture, anti-imperialistic policies still, but we're not as active as a group. The other organization I'm involved with, the National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance, that group is still more active, and it has activists from several other states, not just around the Washington, D.C. area. We have activists in as far away as Alaska, Kansas, Wisconsin, and California. And so we try and coordinate our actions, but there's small actions that we do periodically in different parts of the country. I mean, probably more happen here in D.C. just by virtue of it being the nation's capital.
Pete, why do you think the anti-war movement has kind of dwindled in the last couple of years?
I think a lot of people initially felt disempowered when the war in Iraq actually happened. There was this massive mobilization, which I don't think we've ever seen before, in the U.S. and Europe against going into the Iraq war. And literally, the Bush-Cheney regime didn't care what people had to say. In fact, Cheney, in a couple interviews, has been asked about public opinion against the war and occupation, and his response was, "So what?"
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I feel very strongly about that. If we don't act, then the politicians can say, "So what? It's just public opinion." And so I think when the war actually happened, a lot of people felt disempowered and felt that the politicians weren't listening to them. Many of us in the anti-war movement now, though, believe that the answer doesn't reside with the politicians. It resides with the people itself. And really, that's, you know, you go back to the founding of our government or the founding documents such as the Constitution, and really the power really ought to reside with the people.
And at some level, it seems as though the people are pretty passive about that.
Overall, there are moments where people, I can tell, want to act, but for many different reasons, they don't. I don't know if it's their sense of security, fear that's instilled in them, but that's why the established status quo is able to continue operating without much regard towards public opinion. If we simply say, okay, well, I'm going to go home and turn on the TV and let the news be brought to me instead of trying to go out there and shape the news, then we don't, you know, nothing much is going to be changed. It's quite sad, actually, to see people give up their own power.
Right.
And my great hope is that people gradually realize that they do have quite a bit of power within themselves.
Mm-hmm. And you were involved in something today. Would you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, this morning was sort of the conclusion of a 24-hour vigil in Lafayette Square that happens every week during Torture Survivors Week in June. And it was organized by the Torture Abolition Survivors Support Coalition. And I think the Washington Metro D.C. area, there's between 40 and 50,000 torture survivors from all over the world. And the sad thing in the last few years is that the U.S. clearly has been involved in systematic torture, probably increasing since 9/11 and Guantanamo Bay, and now what you have, Bagram and Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, now being doubled in size by the Obama administration.
And spilling over to...
So it's very important to be out there in Lafayette Park right across from the White House. And there are many torture survivors that were there. And I participated this morning by getting in a cage and putting on the orange jumpsuit and black hood to represent a torture survivor.
Well, Pete Perry, I want to thank you for doing that and for being with us. We will continue this discussion today with Michelle Grease about the court case that occurred after you were arrested. And thank you for being here.
Thank you, Susan.
That was Pete Perry we just talked to, and now let's turn to Michelle Grease. Michelle Grise is a previous convener for the National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance and has been active with this group since 2004. Michelle has been arrested numerous times while trying to stop the war and today talks with us about the court case deriving from the January 20th event in which she was arrested. Welcome, Michelle Grise. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Sue.
Describe a little bit about the arrest, how it was for you, and then go into the details of the court case. The trial itself.
Sure. I think it was a very interesting day. The day we went to Congress, we went to the Hart Building, the Hart Senate Building in Washington, D.C., on the day that the new Congress was being sworn in. And 70 people had marched earlier that day remembering the dead in Iraq and Afghanistan and in Gaza. And when we, a few of us, probably about 20, arrived at the Hart Building at different points in time that afternoon. And we started reading names of the dead. And in fact, of the 20 or so that were there, only a few at a time were reading names. It was a very solemn occasion of gathering. And one person at a time would speak a name of somebody who had passed away in one of these actions. And at one point, another group had unfurled some banners that day, and there was cheering. But in the atrium, you have to remember it's an 8-foot-high center foyer. And tourists are going in and out all the time. There were many people beside the people gathered to read the names. And at a certain point, police started forming around those who had gathered to read the names. And the police, in fact, far outnumbered the people reading the names. We were charged with disorderly conduct, and we were charged with unlawful assembly. And in the charge of disorderly conduct, the government's required to prove that we were loud, boisterous, obscene, that we had disrupted business, etc. And when we went to court on June 22nd, we had a very vigorous case laid out that we were prepared to argue, and we felt very strongly that we would win this case, as some of the other cases we've been winning recently, too. The government had been asked to furnish us with discovery about notes, videos, any radio logs, because some of the people who were involved in the March of the Dead had previously been spied upon in the national security spy case in Maryland. So, you know, we've learned to ask for discovery. And we were not furnished any of that up until even the day that we appeared in court. And when we appeared in court, we made a motion for dismissal for that very reason. And in any other case that wasn't political, it would be standard procedure, and that would be thrown out. The government did not do what it was supposed to do.
Michelle, why do you think they were not following the proper court procedures?
Well, I think that political activists, especially over the last 8 years, have not been treated with the same rules that anybody else would be in the courtroom. What we're doing has been marginalized by the media and by the mainstream media, and the courts have, and the government prosecutors have just found that it's easy enough to just come in and say you broke the law and handed over a verdict of guilty. And most people have accepted that. They've, you know, if they've even pursued their court cases, the people in the National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance in particular, we take these things to court and we pursue it, you know, through the appeals level. But they've learned to use the power that they've had for the last 8 years, again, to just make the laws as they go along, and the courts have followed suit.
Mm-hmm. And it's really frightening because we're even seeing a drop-off amongst those protesting the war. Meanwhile, we have this rise of technology and robotics to sort of process an automatic war that really people hardly need to be involved in at all.
Right. Yeah, it's a very clinical, you know, everything's been edited for you. It's been given you in a small sound bite. People aren't meant to really think about it. And the repercussions are heavy. I mean, when you see the situation in Guantanamo where the public is not outraged enough to cause the changes that need to be made there, where you can imprison people with no charges for years at a time, it makes the average person who in this economic time can hardly make a mortgage payment a little reticent about putting themselves on the line and possibly facing a jail sentence of their own.
Exactly. Well, let's go on with that particular day in court, because you finally, the case was dismissed. But
yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was. At a certain point, in fact, moments before the government was putting on their case, they explained to Judge Rufus King, who was presiding that day, that they just now found out that there was, in fact, film that the police had taken, but they didn't have it with them that day. And so the judge called for a two-hour delay. And again, instead of just throwing the case out, you know, the government had had since January to prepare for this case and to ask for this evidence, and it did not properly acquire the discovery that was asked for by the defense. In any other kind of case, it's just a procedural thing that's expected, and it would have been thrown out. And again, the judge gave a two-hour delay, asked the government to get the tape and bring it back. When we resumed in court, then the government said, oh, geez, I was just told that we had this video footage, but now I found out the police destroyed the evidence. And even the judge looked shocked and asked the police officer about that, and the police officer said, well, after 6 weeks of the event that was being filmed, if nobody's requested the video footage, that they were good, they destroyed the evidence. And the judge said, even when you knew you had an ongoing court case, around this action? And the police officer answered, yes. Hmm. Again, instead of throwing the case out, what Judge King decided at that point was that we could have a particular procedure where we would be allowed to argue that had we had this evidence, we could have proven this, because the judge himself said it could only be for our benefit, the defense's benefit, that that tape was destroyed. So again, the case went forward, and when the police officer was asked during his routine taking notice of the event that was happening, how he proceeded, he said he took notes, and we immediately stopped him and asked, Rick Iverson was one of the attorneys working with one of the defendants, and he asked where the notes were, and the police officer said, well, they might be at home, or they might have gone away.
Hmm.
Again, these were things that we had asked for in discovery, standard procedure. At that point, Judge King asked for a recess, came back, and again, instead of throwing the case out at that point, he said instead he would just throw out this officer's testimony,
hmm.
at which point the government did drop the case because he was their sole witness.
Oh. Is there anything to learn from this?
Well, we certainly learned, you know, to be even more specific in asking for our discovery. I think the government certainly learned a lot. I think what they've seen as we've proceeding through different appeals for different cases that have occurred over the last couple of years, that we're not going away. Even this morning, you know, three friends of mine are in jail, you know, for speaking out. And we're not going to go away, and we will continue to, you know, speak out for what's right. We will continue at our own personal sacrifices to put ourselves on the line. And once we get to the appeals cases, I feel very confident. You know, the judges asked very good questions, and we're waiting for our first rulings, and we expect them to be really in our favor. And I think that's where we're going to see our First Amendment rights being reestablished, those that we've lost that a lot of people aren't even aware of.
Hmm. So do you think that this new President Obama is the bellwether in a way for the new direction, that things just got really sloppy during the Bush years because they could?
I wish I could say that, but I don't. I don't see any big changes. I think maybe as far as the activists go, I don't see policy on the war changing, and I see our work continuing. In recent actions, we have seen the government dropping some charges. We have seen times where we had previously been arrested doing an action where we're not getting arrested. So I think the local police forces are not feeling a heavy burden from an administration to just quell dissent in the same manner. But I think it's going to be an upward battle that we're going to have to really work hard at turning around.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, talk a little bit about the three people that were arrested today. What were they protesting?
Joy First, Malachi Kilbride, and Eve Taitaz are all members of the National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance, and they were at the White House. I'm sorry, it was yesterday. White House yesterday with a group of people, torture survivors, speaking out. And they were three of five who were arrested and three who were kept actually all weekend long. They will not come before the magistrate until Monday. And instead of paying a protest tax, which is the way activists are intimidated and how the government tries to teach us a lesson, is to pay money.
Is that a new tax?
Well, that's what we call it, is a protest tax or a First Amendment tax, because, you know, that's what it is. We, you know, we're doing what we're constitutionally allowed to do, and rather than face two-year battles in the court system and a lot of money, a lot of people are intimidated, especially people who have to come from out of town to just pay the tax and go home.
Mm-hmm.
But these three individuals are longtime activists, and two of them are D.C. citizens, and Joy First comes all the way from Madison, but they refuse, you know, to pay for something that they haven't done wrongly. And so they will sit in jail all weekend long and demand the trial that they're entitled to continue their work in speaking out against injustice. And again, on behalf of the torture victims this time, and also on behalf of our First Amendment rights.
Michelle Griset, I want to thank you for being with us. But before you leave us, could you talk a little bit about the name that you were representing the day that you were arrested? I think it was, did you say Mohammed Hamid?
Yes, Mohammed Hamid. He was a 17-year-old. He was killed on the 29th of December in 2008. And I happen to have a 17-year-old son myself, and so it's a name that I will never forget. And you know, it'll be hard for me to forget what a mother's anguish will be at losing her child.
Remember Mohammed Hamid and all of the other people that have been killed in Gaza, in Iraq, and Afghanistan, and Pakistan now. It just seems to go on and on, doesn't it?
Yes, and you know, and now we have the worries of, you know, how the U.S. is going to involve itself in Iran, and it does go on and on. Our work, you know, someday I had hoped to retire to the Midwest where it was warm, and I think I'll be in, you know, the D.C. area working to try to stop injustice.
Well, thank you for doing that, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Susan.
That was Michelle Griset, herself a mother of four boys who resides in Reston, Virginia.
Was it Cesar Chavez? Maybe it was Dorothy Day. Some have said Dr. King or Gandhi sent them on their way. No matter who your mentors are, it's pretty plain to see. If you've been to jail for justice, you're in good company. Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand. Sitting in and laying down our ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Oh, you're a friend of mine.
Annie and the Vets, have you been to jail for justice? Another member of the group arrested on January 6th is Robert Disu, a peace and justice activist who currently attends the Catholic University of America. Disu's activist career started by organizing candlelight vigils while still in high school on Long Island. After moving to D.C. to college, he became more actively involved in the anti-war occupation movement. He has worked with several anti-war groups and is currently with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. He's been arrested three times, first on September 13th in front of the White House after marching the final leg of the March for Peace. That was from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. He was also arrested during Stop Loss Congress in an attempt to enforce stop loss orders on members of Congress. Then during the January 6th inauguration of the 111th Congress, he unfurled the large banner that Pete Perry referred to earlier that read, "The Audacity of War Crimes." Welcome, Robert Disu.
Hi, how are you?
It's good to have you with us. So give us your perspective on the January 6th event.
Well, I think it was a very important action. I mean, it was right when the siege of Gaza was happening, and it was coming to light that the Democrats are now getting elected, or obviously elected, and now we're going to start on their mission to supposedly bring true progressive values to the United States. And it's always important to remind them that they still have to work. And I think that was one of the main points of the action, was to show we are not, just because you got elected and you said you're going to be progressive, doesn't mean we're not going to make sure you stay progressive.
And the audacity of war, of course, was a direct reflection on his audacity of hope.
Yes, it was on a direct parody, I guess, or satire of Obama's book, Audacity of Hope, and showed that there are war crimes happening, and there are U.S.-sanctioned war crimes in Gaza and U.S. performing war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq.
What happened with the court case?
It came to light that the government was really just putting us on a show trial. I really don't think they ever had an intention of going through the trial. I think they were just trying to sap as much energy out of us as they could. I mean, you know, Elizabeth Myers, the prosecuting DA, didn't give us evidence. She refused to answer our phone calls. Lori Arbiter and the other people who was arrested actually sent out a mass email telling people to call Elizabeth Myers and ask for our charges to be dropped. So I think we got the government on the offensive instead. And put us on the offensive, and they got scared, and, you know, they destroyed evidence and got up on the stand and said, we're not going to act, we have this evidence, but we didn't give it to you.
And so you're going to continue with the work you're doing, including now the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. Talk a little bit about that campaign.
I'm going to start on Monday. I'm going to be doing some consulting work and helping them build a stronger connection to the student, youth, and anti-war movement. Since the students and youth make up the majority anti-war movement, we're often kind of pushed to the side and used as bodies. And one of my main goals as being an organizer is to bring respect back to the students and get students back involved in progressive values and progressive justice.
And why do you think the students these days seem to have taken a back seat to the in the protests that have been going on?
Well, I mean, I don't think they've taken a complete backseat. I think SDS is a perfect example. That's a completely student-run organization, and they've done some really amazing work in NYU and the New School. But I think youth have a tendency to get over-involved, either get over-involved and get very radical about an issue, or completely don't care and don't realize how it's affecting them. Like, the average age of a soldier killed in Iraq is 21. You know, that's people, that's someone my age is the average age. The average age of an Iraqi is 21. Like, you know, these are people that are our age. I think once people realize that these crimes are happening to people like us, it slowly will awaken them.
I know at Stanford, it's a lot of the times students just have way too much on their plate, plus they have to work to pay off their school loans and to afford school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a big balancing act. I'm a full-time student. I'm going to probably be going to grad school in next fall, you know, but I've learned that I have to balance it. And what is really important to me is doing well in school and to do everything I can to end the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, along with many other issues.
Robert Disu, talk a little bit about the Stop Loss Congress.
Stop Loss Congress was a 3-day event that I organized with David Rubinson and Jamil Al-Shafai. It was a part of our spring break, which is a 2-week direct action camp that I am the co-founder of with Ashley Cassell. Basically, it was bringing to light the fact that the way these occupations are continuing is through stop losses. We're preventing U.S. soldiers from going home, and that's how they're sustaining the occupation. So we went to Congress, we went to the House and the Senate, and we delivered stop loss orders to them. And we said, now you're doing this to the troops, now we're going to do it to you. And then on Wednesday the 12th, we blockaded the exits out of the Senate Hart building and out of the House, out of the Rayburn building on the House side.
Mm-hmm. And how did that go down?
I think it went pretty well. We prevented them from leaving for about an hour, I'd say. And then as they pushed us to the side, so I was on the Hart side, they pushed us to the side, and while they were arresting us, it was a single file line of cars, and it was senators and staffers driving by, hearing a bunch of students and youth screaming, "Give Iraqis their country back." And I mean, that has to have an impact on someone. You see someone as you're driving by, forced to go slowly because you can't go too fast by the cops, and you have someone in handcuffs still screaming, "Give the Iraqis their country back."
The thing that's going on now, though, there's a new technology, this unmanned aerial vehicle technology, the robotics technology, that's really beginning to be very interesting and exciting to both the military, the CIA, and a few other groups. That is essentially going to, in the long run, take war out of the hands of everyday people. There will hardly be any more troops in the military. This is something that we really need to be aware of. Again, this is something that we're only just becoming aware of now. How do you see that?
No, absolutely. I think it's all a part of the dehumanization of war. You know, the way that we make war acceptable is we don't talk about it. We don't talk about the harsh reality of it. And by switching from a U.S. To a human persona to a drone, you dehumanize it to the point where it really is no human. You know, government has done a great job of dehumanizing the Iraqi people and the Afghan people to the point where it's like 1.2 million of them died, and it's like not even a thing. It's not even a question. So I think it's really just an attempt to dehumanize war to the point where it really isn't human, and it's just to the point where people don't realize what the harsh reality of it is.
And it's hard to even get it up on their radars, so to speak.
Yeah. You know, you just hear robots, you know. Oh, well, that's, you know, it's just robots. It's not going to do anything. But, you know, what? I think on the day of our trial, I think a drone bombed a funeral and killed 40 people. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there's still weapons of destruction. They're still killing innocent life for empire and profit.
Yeah, in fact, the funeral that was in, was going on was people that had been killed by a drone attack.
Mm.
So, well, I want to thank you for being with us, and we're going to keep on with this conversation about war, ending war, and how to go about doing that, and I want to thank you for participating.
Thank you.
Pete Perry, Michelle Grisset, and Robert Disu will continue their work to end the war. I hope the example is an inspiration to those of us who want to get involved, know they need to get more involved in American democratic processes, and either don't know what to do or just need a boost from folks like the example of these three activists that we have shared, whose stories we've shared today. If you're one of those, this is a good time to become active. The Stereo MCs with Writings on the Wall. The Rebuilding Alliance is a Palo Alto, California-based not-for-profit organization that rebuilds homes and other infrastructures in war-torn communities and makes them safe. You can learn more about this organization by calling 650-325-4663, or if you are a local resident of Palo Alto, the environment surrounding areas, drop by and introduce yourself to the people at the Rebuilding Alliance at 235 Elma Street, Palo Alto. That's just on the edge of the downtown area. And where you can purchase olive oil from the Rebuilding Alliance from Palestine's ancient trees, some of which date back as far as Roman times and even before that. Again, call 650-325-4663, or you can visit the website at rebuildingalliance.org. The implications of UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones is profound. Who is in charge of researching this technology? Who is in charge of the different and increasing numbers of drone forays in war? How does this technology affect real-life military personnel? If troops become redundant, how do we, the people, respond to a technology that is even more out of sight, out of mind than much of war and combat is already? Pete Singer is author of many books, including the recent Wired for War, and he's with the Brookings Institute. We'll have an in-depth interview one-on-one with Pete Singer on Raising San Radio in the near future to deepen our understanding of the future of war. In the meantime, though, I wanted to share a short segment with Singer that was aired on KALW's Your Call with Rose Aguilar.
You have a pilot and a sensor operator who will be sitting in what's actually a trailer at an Air Force base, typically outside of Las Vegas. Creech Air Force Base is where they're flying most of them out of. And they will be operating it almost like a video game, you know, controlling a joystick through a monitor. And yet the system that they're flying, be it a Predator drone or a Reaper drone, for example, will be over Iraq or over Afghanistan or even Pakistan at the time. And so their communications with it, their controls of it, are beamed up via satellite over. And so it's this very weird existence for them, and that, you know, just as you noted, it's taking the whole idea of going to war and turning it on its head. You know, when you going to war, my grandfather went to war in the Pacific in World War II. That meant that you went to a place where there was such danger, you might never come home again. You might never see your family again. Well, for these pilots, you know, going to war is basically like commuting into work. And they spend 12 hours, you know, putting missiles on targets, observing what's happening. And then at the end of the day, they get back in their car and they drive home. And as one of them put it, you know, 20 minutes after being at war, you're at the dinner table talking to your kid about their homework.
Hmm. A number of activists have been protesting at this Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, and a few of them said that it was almost surreal because they could see the drones actually taking off from that area. So how big are they?
It depends on the system. Robots come in all shapes and sizes today. It's very much science fiction coming to life. So give you a typical example, a Global Hawk. Global Hawk is about the size of a little bigger than a small passenger jet. It can take off and land on its own. So you're not really talking about pilots operating it as almost managing it. Hmm. Take off and land on its own. It can then fly 3,000 miles on its own using GPS. Then spend 24 hours in the air, so it's the replacement for the U-2 spy plane. So you can spend 24 hours over an area, you know, hunting down terrorists using high-powered cameras, electronic intercept, you name it. And then at the end of that 24 hours in the air, fly itself back 3,000 miles and land itself. But you also have, you know, what I call teeny tiny robots. One of the systems that I saw was basically it could fit on the tip of your finger. You can imagine it as being a bug with a bug. Hmm. That is, it's a spying device, but it's like a little bug that you wouldn't even notice if it was there in your room.
And those are used for surveillance?
What we see happening is, this is the parallel to the early airplanes back in World War One. You know, the first ones are for surveillance, for watching what the other side's doing. And then someone says, you know what, I can see what the other guy's doing. I want to do something about it. And so they at first jury-rig arm them. And that's the case that happened with the early Predator drones, same thing that's happened with the ground robots. This is another booming field. We have more than 12,000 of these in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so then once you've jury-rigged arm it, then you start to plan them out specifically to be armed. And that's, for example, the Reaper drone, which is the replacement for the Predator drone. It's a deliberately planned to be an armed drone. And then you, of course, get to the stage where it's, I don't just want to look at the bad guy and kill them, but I also want to do something about their system. So just like we got fighter planes, the same thing is starting to happen with our robotic drones, drones designed to shoot down other drones. The targeting follows pretty much the same way you would with a manned bomber in terms of the hoops that you have to jump through, the authorization orders that need to happen for that. They get intelligence on what a target might be. You know, we think there's a terrorist hiding out in this compound of houses. Now, the difference with an unmanned drone is it can loiter above it for hours and hours on end, watching it via a high-powered video camera. And then once they think they have that target, they get authorization, and they might drop a bomb, they might shoot a missile at it. And then the thing is they watch it going in. Now,
Does this authorization from someone in Nevada?
It would depend on the strike mission. It might be it's the commanding officer. Now, the thing with the strikes into Pakistan is they are somewhat different than the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan because most of these are CIA missions, not U.S. military missions. And there's some confusion as to, you know, what are the chain of commands that you have to follow in that situation as opposed to with a military operation where you have a very strict, you know, everything has to be cleared by the commanding officer. It also has to be cleared by a military lawyer, a JAG officer's there. And that's one of the concerns that people in the military have is that maybe by handing these systems over to a civilian intelligence agency, maybe you're doing a little bit too much. There's another part of this, of course, and this is what I wrestle with in the book, is not just the technology, what can it do, what's the impact of all of this?
Right.
And so we've actually had just about as many strikes into Pakistan as we did in the opening round of the Kosovo War. Mm. And yet we don't talk about it in our politics. We don't debate about it in Congress the way we did the Kosovo War. And I would argue it's because these are riskless to us, maybe not on the other side, but to us, It's we're not sending people into harm's way, and so it's not forcing that kind of political debate that maybe you should be having when you're talking really about, you know, acts of war.
And is this why we've seen such an increase? It's amazing that you report the U.S. military went into Iraq with a handful of drones in the air. There are now about 5,300.
We're actually up to 7,000.
Up to 7,000?
Yeah, since the book got published, we added another 1,700. I mean, and the book just came out about, 7 weeks ago. So it's just amazing the growth here. Bill Gates put it really well. He said, robots are where computers were in 1980. And the way to think about this is the military is the primary researcher and developer, and then you have a limited set of applications. If you remember computers back in 1980, there's only a couple of things you could do with them. And then each time you prove a new application, it expands into a new area and expands more and more. And then the thing is, it forces all of these political and ethical and social dilemmas that you weren't expecting to have. So, you know, no one back in 1980 looking at the thing the computer said, you know, aha, this is going to allow, a phenomenon called social networking, which is going to allow me to be friends with someone in China I've never met, but also mean that, you know, some mother in San Francisco is worried about her kid being found by a child predator from Montreal. You know, all that comes out of the computer. And it's the same thing that's happening with robotics, these unexpected ripple effects onto our politics and our laws and our ethics. This is the new wave of war, and it's not a right-left issue. You know, it's just like the introduction of the plane back in World War One, or the introduction of the tank. You know, these systems are used. I think there was a really great quote in the book, and it was from a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, actually for Ronald Reagan. He said, look, I like these systems because they save lives. But I also worry about more marketization of war, more shock and awe talk to defray discussion of the costs of war. And that's his quote. And I think it really captures well the thing. You know, you have hundreds, literally hundreds of American soldiers who are alive today because of the use of these robots. The book opens up actually with a scene of a bomb defusing robot, and the commander talks about how much he likes it because he doesn't have to write a letter home to someone's mother if that robot gets blown up. But, you know, that has another side to it, which is that maybe it gets us into things that we shouldn't. And then, of course, what are the laws of war if, you know, the robot kills the wrong person? I mean, these are all sort of new questions that sound like science fiction, but they're very much something of our world right now.
Again, this is an excerpt from Your Call, KALW's Your Call with Pete Singer, and we'll be doing more with Pete Singer. I just wanted to whet our appetite about the kinds of information that he'll be sharing with us, and also take a quick look at this technology. A few weeks ago, I reported on a protest taking place outside Creech Air Force Base near Indian Springs in Nevada, where remote piloting of drones is carried out. There'll be another action for peace outside this base this coming weekend. Beginning July 2nd, a caravan will depart the Bay Area for Los Angeles and continue over to Las Vegas and up to Creech, where a women's encampment will be set up. It will be hot, and I don't just mean hot weather. And you can learn more about it and how to get involved by calling 510-540-7007 or emailing info@bayareacodepink.org. Again, if you're in the mood for learning more about these drones, this drone technology, taking a long ride to Nevada, call 510-540-7007 or email info@bayareacodepink.org. And that's our show for today. As usual, views and opinions are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Join us again next week as we turn to issues facing war veterans, from healing the traumas of war to the process of integrating war veterans back into society. Meanwhile, you can contact me at Susan@RaisingSandRadio.org or visit our website at RaisingSandRadio.org. Let's go out with the Stereo MCs and Writings on the Wall.
I'm gonna do it again. I'm gonna do it again.